Okay, we'll call the meeting to order of the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee and start out with roll call.
Representative Cornish, Chair.
Here.
Representative Johnson, Vice Chair.
Here.
Representative Constein.
Here.
Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Hertas.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Quam.
Here.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Schoen. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Winkler. And Representative Zerwas.
Okay, having a quorum being present, somebody want to make a motion to approve the minutes for January 14th.
Yes. So moved.
Move has been made and seconded by...
Second.
Second. Motion been made and seconded to approve the minutes of January 14th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now we're going to get... Okay, today we have the great pleasure to have the Department of Public Safety in front of us, a couple of friends of mine, Commissioner Doman, and is Assistant Commissioner or Deputy, or is it?
Mr. Chair, Deputy, no, sir.
Deputy Commissioner, sorry about that. I should have known. And Daninsky. And you folks can go right ahead and start, and I think we'll probably let you go on, unless there's a very important question. We'll have the members take notes as they go instead of interrupt you. But members, if you're really anxious to answer one, you can still raise your hand and ask it. But otherwise, we'll wait till we get done with each division and then ask the questions. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, and I am the Commissioner of Public Safety. And to my left is Deputy Commissioner Mark Danaski. He has been actually serving as the Deputy Commissioner since beginning of July of 2014, when Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison retired after a long public service career. And so I'm glad to have him on board as the deputy. For those of you who don't know me, I think there are some new members to the committee and some new members to the legislature. I've been a police officer for 32 years, and I served in the cities of Glencoe, Minnesota, and Marshall, Minnesota for a short period of time, and then in 1984 I moved to Maple Grove, where I served as a police officer there for 27 years. The last 10 of those years I served as the police chief for the city of Maple Grove, and then in March of 2011 I came to the Department of Public Safety after being appointed by Governor Dayton. So I feel very honored and very privileged to serve in this capacity and to be able to work with Governor Dayton and his staff, and certainly all of you, as we work to protect the people of Minnesota, one of our core functions of government. So good morning, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be here, to meet with you. And we are here to provide, as the chair said, an overview of our agency, the Department of Public Safety. And we recognize for some of you that this may be a refresher, as we've given a similar presentation that has been melded with our budget presentations over the past years. But for some of you, this will be new. And we look forward to answering any questions that you might have. Behind me in the room are all of our division directors. And as Deputy Commissioner gives his piece of the presentation, he will be introducing each of them so that you can put a name with a face as we go about. So we recognize that this isn't a budget presentation. This is just an overview. And regardless, we appreciate the opportunity and we'll answer any questions. Our overall mission at the Department of Public Safety is to work to create a safer Minnesota for all. We work to protect the citizens and the communities in which they live. Throughout each of our 10 divisions, on a daily basis, and specific to the responsibilities of each division, we work to prevent, to prepare, to respond, to recover, to educate, and to enforce. And these are our constant efforts in all of the divisions. As we do this, our focus is on saving lives and providing efficient and effective services to the people that we serve. And within all of this, we work every day to maintain the public trust and develop and sustain strong relationships and partnerships with public safety partners and professionals across the state. That last statement that I made is critical when you think about and realize that almost everything that we do at the Department of Public Safety in every division really is a service to our partners across the state and to the people of Minnesota, whether it be the BCA agents responding to and assisting local law enforcement in violent crime and homicide investigations, or driver and vehicle services working with deputy registrars across the state, or for example, the state fire marshal assisting local firefighters with fire investigations. Our work has direct impact on citizens and our public safety partners, and we recognize the need for strong relationships across the board. Additionally, as you well know, the core function of government is public safety, and we work closely with the governor and with you to ensure that we accomplish that. The next slide is a snapshot of our total Department of Public Safety budget. For the current biennium, fiscal year 14-15, our base budget is approximately $776 million, comprised of appropriations from trunk highway funds, state government special revenue accounts, highway user tax distribution funds, miscellaneous special revenue funds, and the general fund. And how we spend the appropriations is the next slide. Local assistance, transfers, payments to individuals, operating costs, and then total compensation to the employees at the Department of Public Safety. As I mentioned earlier, we have 10 divisions at the department, and we are unique in that our budget falls into two areas, the Transportation Policy and Finance Committees and the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committees. And this slide shows actually which divisions fall into each. So we have under Transportation, the Minnesota State Patrol, our Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, the Office of Pipeline Safety, and the administration and related support services at our agency. And then under Public Safety, which this committee has jurisdiction over, is our Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, the Fire Marshals Division, our Office of Justice Programs, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and then the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And so I am now going to turn it over to the Deputy Commissioner, and he will go through each of the divisions within our agency.
Deputy Commissioner Donenski, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Committee members, I thought I'd just walk down through the transportation falls, the divisions that fall under the transportation, just so the members that are new have a little better understanding of what they are. First, as the Commissioner mentioned, the Minnesota State Patrol. The State Patrol's mission is to protect and serve all people in the state through assistance, education, and enforcement, provide support to its allied agencies, and provide for the safe, efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota's roadways. The State Patrol is our largest division, having 807 sworn and non-sworn individuals in that organization. Next is the Office of Traffic Safety. The mission of the Office of Traffic Safety is to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing human behavior in Minnesota through policy development and support, stakeholder engagement, program delivery, leadership, and research and evaluation. And I should note that the Office of Traffic Safety and the Minnesota State Patrol work hand-in-hand with the Department of Transportation and the Department of Health. And you may have heard recently that Minnesota once again is ranked one of the top states in the country as far as our traffic safety programs and the number of fatalities in the state. Next is our Driver and Vehicle Services Division. DVS is committed to what they refer to as FAST, which is fair, accurate, secure, and timely service. Through effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, and quality information and technical support for staff and our business partners. DVS is also a rather large organization in our department. It has 538 employees across 95 locations in the state of Minnesota. And I'll also note that through the Department of Vehicle Services is approximately $1.4 billion is collected through that individual department. The Office of Pipeline Safety, which is actually housed within the Fire Marshal's Office within the Department of Public Safety, has a mission to protect lives, property, and the environment through the implementation of a program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident, and incident investigations, as well as education. And then lastly, on the transportation side, we have our administrative and related services. Within that area is our communications office, the commissioner's office, our human resources department, our fiscal administrative services, as well as the Office of Technology and Support, and our internal affairs division. And so those are the divisions that fall under the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee's oversight. Within the oversight of this particular committee, we have the following divisions. First is our Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, which is led by Director Michelle Tucker. Michelle, could you raise your hand? Thank you. The mission of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division is to maintain the integrity. Thank you, Commissioner. Is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor the state and tribal gaming compacts. Within that division are two separate entities. First is the alcohol enforcement side, which deals with alcohol beverage licensing and permits, brand label registration, the investigation of alcohol-related complaints and investigation of licensed premises, the imposition, if necessary, of civil penalties, and the enforcement of our underage drinking laws in the state. And the other half of Michelle Tuckner's shop is the gambling enforcement side, who's responsible for licensing of the manufacturers and distributors of gambling equipment in the state of Minnesota. They ensure compliance with state and tribal compacts, and they conduct criminal investigations and enforcement when necessary. For this biennium, FY14-15, AGED has a budget of $1.58 million per year in general fund and $653,000 per year in special revenue direct appropriations. $500,000 of the special revenue receipts are, in fact, transferred to the general fund on an annual basis. These special revenue monies are derived from the Indian Nation compacts, criminal background fees, and gambling forfeitures. Mr. Chair, would you like me to pause after each division?
Yeah, if you could pause for a second, Commissioner, I'll give Representative Schoen a comment.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, and I know you wanted questions at the end, but if it's possible, Assistant Commissioner, if you could just lay out how many staff are in each of those divisions while you're at it so I don't try to get you to go back at the end. I know I don't see it in the presentation. If it's not possible and you need to bring everybody up for that, just maybe we can get that. But that if you're able to, I'd like to know how many people are doing the alcohol side, how many people are doing the gambling side, how many people are in the, and as it goes through the rest of the presentation too.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I move through, why don't we have our staff kind of huddle up and we'll get all that information for you so we can give that at one time.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Next, we have the State Fire Marshal Division, which is led by State Fire Marshal Bruce West. Bruce is right here. Bruce also serves as the Director of Office of Pipeline Safety. As I mentioned, it's kind of an odd situation. The Office of Pipeline Safety, which is under the purview of the Transportation Committee, is actually housed within a division that's under the purview of your committee. The mission of the State Fire Marshal is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment. For the biennium of 14-15, the Fire Marshal's Office receives $4.487 million per year in special revenue direct appropriations, and that does come from the fire safety account. Services within the Fire Marshal Division include investigations both on its own and in support of other local entities, the enforcement of state fire codes, monitoring and enforcement of regulations, emergency response when necessary. They collect data across the state from all the fire departments on incidents that they respond to. And, of course, the Fire Marshal's Office is heavily involved in public education on fire safety across the state. Mr. Chair, shall I continue?
Okay, any questions? Move into the next section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, we have the Office of Justice Programs, which is led by Director Rayon Magnuson. The mission of the Office of Justice Programs, or OJP, is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and to assist crime victims. In the biennium of 14-15, OJP received general fund direct appropriation of $36 million. In addition to its programming, OJP administers grants to nonprofits and local units of government totaling $50 million per year. Some of the services provided by OJP include crime victim reparations, the Crime Victim Justice Unit, grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims in the area of general crime, abused children, battered women and domestic violence, sexual assault, and they have an emergency grant program. They provide training and communication, they have a statistical analysis center, and they provide justice and community grants in the areas to reduce crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and violence.
For a member's information, the OJP has been discussed for numbers of years, and we had some problems in the past. We seem to be working through those, and where it was the opinion of some of our members that the programs that were granted out at the same amount, $40,000, $40,000, $40,000, no matter, it seemed like what the workload was of the different places that got those grants. I think they've gotten a lot better at that and distributing the money as needed. But it saves us a lot of work because a lot of our bills are in grant form that goes to the OJP. Then they take care of, once we make the decision of the how much goes there, then they sort through and get the applications from the different people that apply for them and figure out who should actually get the grant and in what amount. And if we have a problem with that, they've got a pretty good job of paperwork trail where we can look through those and see if there's any problems. I mean, there was one area in my district that didn't make the cut and didn't get any money. And so we looked into it, and it was just a competitive grant system where that year they didn't get it. Some you don't always. The other little bit of a problem we got is that the only thing bad about getting a grant every year is that some people's turns out to be a budget instead of a grant, and if they don't get it or they fear they're not going to get it, their whole world falls apart. So there are glitches in the system, but overall it works pretty good for us. So any questions on the OJP? Okay, Commissioner, you can move into the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next we have our Division of Emergency Communication Networks, which is referred to as ECM. It's led by Director Jackie Mines. The mission of ECN is to utilize emerging technology to provide the most comprehensive emergency communication networks available. By developing professional partnerships and collaborating with our customers, they deliver customer-focused network solutions that enhance public safety. For FY14 funding of $64.2 million and for FY15 funding of $70.5 million from the 911 Emergency Services account of the Special Revenue Fund was appropriated to ECN. On the 911 side, ECN collects a monthly fee, and this is where this money comes from. ECN collects a monthly fee that's assessed upon all wired, wireless, prepaid wireless, and packet-based communications. They contract with the telephone companies to provide for the 911 networks in the state of Minnesota. They administer grants to the public safety answering points, and you'll commonly hear them referred to as PSAPs. Those are the 911 centers, such as the sheriff's offices. When somebody dials 911 on any of the devices that we just talked about, there are approximately 110 centers across the state that are PSAPs. They also provide technical assistance to the PSAPs, and they're in the process of developing a migration strategy for the next generation 911 system. Additionally, ECM provides support and assistance to the ARMOR program, which is the Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Response. That's the 800 megahertz trunked system that we have in the state of Minnesota that supports all public safety and first responders. They support also the Statewide Emergency Communications Board, which you'll hear referred to as the SECB, which is the body that governs the 800 megahertz system as well as all emergency communications.
Yeah, Commissioner, Representative Hilstrom had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me these PSAPs, how do you get an additional one? Or is it just designated by, you're a county unit or a local unit? How do you make the determinations of how many there should be and who gets them?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Commissioner.
In fact, the Commissioner can correct me on this, we've actually seen a decrease in the number of PSAPs in the state of Minnesota. Typically, each county sheriff's office will have an answering point for that particular county, and then a number of other communities, and including the Minnesota State Patrol. The State Patrol at one time had 11 PSAPs across the state, and they've consolidated theirs to two now, and other agencies are going through consolidation. Dakota County had a number of PSAPs. They've consolidated to a singular PSAP within their community as well. So how you would go about it would be the local community or an agency would go forth, and they would decide to fund a PSAP, and then they would do that. But we've seen it going probably in the other direction, that there's been a reduction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So was that locally driven then to consolidate, or was that more from a top-down approach that we had too many, we couldn't afford them, or a technology issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can't speak for the local governments, but in terms of the Minnesota State Patrol, which is a state agency, that was driven by efficiencies and a process that technology allowed us, particularly with the advent of the 800 megahertz system, where we can talk from one point in the state to the other point in the state over the same system, which wasn't available 20 years ago, that we have opportunities now for consolidation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Again, on the Allied Radio Matrix side or the ARMR side, ECN is implementing a statewide standards based on shared digital trunk radio communications network for state and local emergency responders. They are in the process of working with to develop Minnesota's bottom-up local and regional governance structure, which is included in that statewide emergency communications board. And they're implementing a statewide interoperability program with the focus of developing interoperability communications for routine, medium, and large-scale events. And I would also note that Minnesota is well-known across the country for its advancement in our communication system in the state of Minnesota for our ARMR system, as well as the governing process we have across all the jurisdictions for emergency communication.
Okay, folks, any questions? Okay, Commissioner, you can move on to the next category there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, we have Homeland Security Emergency Management, which is led by newly appointed Director Joe Kelly. The mission of the Homeland Security Emergency Management, or HSEM, is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. HSEM's funding, in addition to its extensive program activity, HSEM is a pass-through for sizable federal grant amounts, and you probably have seen some conversations recently about the disasters. They do have a general fund base of $2.3 million per year. They funding sources through federal grants, mostly from Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Administration, are approximately $20 million per year. In FY15, HSEM received a one-time general fund appropriation of $1.574 million and a special revenue fund appropriation of $2.5 million to start moving forward with railroad and pipeline safety in the state of Minnesota. In FY15, initial funding was provided for the disaster contingency account. As I mentioned, preparedness, response, recovery, and prevention are the hallmarks of HSEM. Some of the areas that they're working in that, in the preparation area, as I mentioned, they're working very diligently on enhancing rail safety in the state of Minnesota, as well as school safety through the HSEM School Safety Center and radiological preparedness. In response, they do coordinate the state response from our SEOC, and they coordinate statewide and volunteer resources. In addition, the bomb squads, special response teams, chemical assessment teams, emergency response teams, and the state's structural collapse team are processed through HSEM and coordinated across the state. They administer FEMA disaster programs for recovery, they administer state disaster public assistance programs, and they do coordinate with local long-term recovery committees, which usually stand up after some type of a major disaster. In the prevention area, they do administer the federal mitigation programs and the critical infrastructure protection programs.
Commissioner, do you have a way of providing a county by county list of the current disaster requests or not?
Mr. Chair, yes, we can do that.
If you could. A county by county request of the current disaster request. How many are there counties in that mix?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Joe Kelly. I'm the director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. For the current disasters that began in 2014, there are 37 counties that were designated as eligible for FEMA assistance from the floods, as well as three tribal governments. And then we have had three counties that were designated for the state disaster assistance program.
Okay. And then, not today, but maybe if you could give us a figure on how much for each one was requested or and allotted.
Mr. Chair, members, very quickly, just the top number for each of those categories is for the most recent federal disaster. The total damages to our local communities is $52 million. For the two federal disasters, it's $1.9 million. And we have a county-by-county breakdown, Mr. Chair, to provide you with.
Sounds good. Thank you much. Another question, Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you're providing that, if you could provide the information of what was requested, what was actually given, and so what the unfunded section is, because I think that's what the deficiency bill that's coming has got some additional money for disasters.
Commissioner, or Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we can provide that. In the end, generally the difference why we have a deficiency is not necessarily what was requested and what was funded, but it's what was originally forecast and what was found to be eligible for reimbursement. But we can certainly explain the differences in those numbers.
Thank you.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kelly, you have the radiological preparedness in here. Who is that all for you? Health is part of that too, as well? For instance, down in Cottage Grove, we're one of the reception centers. And I know there's one, where is the other one, up in the northeast, northwest metro for the plant up there?
Director, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have a number of state agency partners to deal with our radiological program. Important one, you mentioned the Department of Health. The Department of Human Services plays a huge role in those reception centers. The one to the north is actually now located in Rogers. And we also work closely with the Department of Military Affairs, Minnesota State Patrol, Department of Transportation. So it's a total state agency team support effort for a radiological program.
And then expanding on that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
Yeah, Mr. Kelly or anybody at the Commission, you don't have to answer this today, but here's information I would like to have about some of the programs related to how we store. For instance, there's a trailer that gets stored in a public storage facility that we lease space or rent space, I believe, related to that program. And I don't know how many other programs that we store and pay monthly fees to a private company or to Acorn Mini Storage or whatever. What I'm curious about is if they're in commonly in a static place, is if we're spending more money leasing that space than it would be for us just to maybe bond for an addition to a local fire station and then say that's going to be our space. If we don't use it, then you can use it. But long term, I'm just looking at what that investment might be. I'd be curious to know what we pay out over the years, because I think heated storage in a public facility is fairly expensive, but I'm guessing there's probably a lot of fire departments around the state that if we do have something in their community, they wouldn't mind if we put an extra stall on for them, because they could use the space and extra storage as well anyway. But and it might be beneficial to both of us. Something to just look into, and I appreciate it.
Sir, Mr. Chair, Representative, be happy to gather that information and report in the future.
Okay, and Director, on the clarification, the request for the projects by county, I guess we've got a list, but we got a list with the names of county and the total, but we don't have what the project is for. If you could list what the project is, what the expenses were. Okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly recognize Joe Kelly. This is actually day two of his new job. So Chris Ide, Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management, retired on the 13th. I appointed Joe Kelly. He took over yesterday. He walked into the wrong office yesterday morning, and he introduced himself wrong this morning. But I just wanted to share with you that this is a new adjustment for him, and I just wanted to share that with you.
We would have known that. We would really put you on this spot.
We're glad to have him as the director.
Well, thank you very much, Director. Okay. Are we done with that one? Next category.
All right, Mr. Chair. Last, we have our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which everybody knows as the BCA, that's led by Superintendent Wade Setter. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension prevents, investigates, and solves crimes in collaboration with our criminal justice partners. It is the BCA is really kind of divided up into four general areas. The first is its investigative section that has its special agents and its analysts, which many of you are familiar with. It operates a predatory offender registration and investigation program. It assists in, and is part of the Financial Crimes Task Force. It works with and assists in cold case investigations. It operates the Internet Crimes Against Children, which you'll hear referred to as ICAC from time to time. It works with local entities in missing and unidentified persons investigations. And within the BCA is housed the Minnesota Fusion Center. The second area within BCA is its criminal, MNJIS, or the Information Systems area. It's a criminal justice training and education. I jumped one ahead here. It's the justice training and education portion. Within that area is the Amber Alert System that sends out alerts for missing children, the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, the DARE program, Minnesota Crime Watch program, the statewide Internet Safety Educational Program, And the Minnesota duty officers are housed within this area of BC, and the duty officers are a 24-hour, 365 operation where local entities call the state, and they have access to all the state resources through that one number. The third area is forensics at the BCA. The BCA has quite a large number of laboratories providing support to local units of government. They include drug, nuclear and mitochondrial DNA, firearms, fingerprints, documents, breath alcohol testing, toxicology, and trace evidence. Under the forensics area is a combined DNA indexing system, and within that area, the BCA also provides crime scene service to local entities across the state, and they also provide a significant amount of training for local units of government. The Minnesota Justice Information Services is another section of the BCA. Within that is housed the Criminal Justice Data Communication Network. They do criminal history background checks. Criminal Justice Reporting System is there. They maintain and administer the Criminal Justice Information Systems. Fingerprint services are operated out of that area. They provide technical support across the state, and they do provide significant training and auditing for those individuals and agencies that are utilizing the state data systems. Funding for the BCA in the biennium has direct appropriations of a total of $42.21 million. Of that, $40.27 million is general fund, and $1.94 million comes from trunk highway fund. And with that, Mr. Chair, I believe the Commissioner and I would take any questions.
Any questions? I've got several here, but I'll let you folks go first.
Okay. What would be an example in your budget of payments to individuals? 1%, it's not a big chunk, but why are we paying people?
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner.
Representative, payments to individuals would be like crime victim services through the Office of Justice program. So if you're a victim of crime.
Oh, thank you.
And if you want further explanation, we can bring Director Magnuson down to explain that.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question.
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you. What is the Minnesota Fusion Center?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to call on Superintendent Wade Setter to come down and explain the Fusion Center.
We actually have lots of time today, so don't worry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wade Setter. I'm the superintendent of the BCA. The Minnesota Fusion Center, the Fusion Center network on a national level was created after 9/11 as a recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. There's 74 fusion centers around the country. Every state has one, and there is some major urban areas like Milwaukee, for example, has one. We only have one in Minnesota. Essentially, it's for the sharing, collection, and transfer of information between federal, state, and local law enforcement partners, primarily with a Homeland Security focus.
So just distribution of information.
We also analyze data and provide information. For example, yesterday we had a secure video teleconference with the FBI talking about the Paris terrorism attacks. We try to take that information and share with our other local partners in the state as a term of preparedness in the counterterrorism environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to touch base on the Homeland Security, the emergency management area. Thank you for coming out and meeting with us today. It's always good to get brought up to speed on things. Last session, we had passed some legislation to increase some of the safety for rail. That's a big concern for my district and many of the folks in this room. We have, for example, we have the Burlington Northern Rail Line that basically runs the spine of the state. On any given day, if I drive up Highway 10, if I start in Big Lake or Becker, and I drive all the way up to Royalton or out of my district, all points in between, at any time, you're going to see a unit train, 110, 100, 90, plus these big tanker cars with that highly volatile Bakken crude, which has a flammability temperature of about 75 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a big concern, as you know, that these petroleum products are exceedingly volatile. I've seen some video of these these trains derail, you have an accident. One train car alone can go up to about a mile after it explodes. So we have these 40,000 gallons per car, and we got these unit trains that are 90, 100, 110 train car long, and they're just stopped. And you drive up the highway, and there's a 110 unit train, and it sits there sometimes for hours, sometimes over the course of the weekend. You'll drive another couple of miles, there's another one stopped. You drive another couple of miles, there's another one stopped, and they're just queued up, and they're not going anywhere. I have a real concern with these trains. I mean, not only with the nature of what they're carrying, but also, you know, these things are running at 60 miles an hour, and they're going right through our communities. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, you know, there's some issues here. And I know that last year we started to try to breach this, to try to get into this and to address this issue. I know this is day two, so I'm going to be real nice. But I'm just curious if you could just bring the committee up to speed on what has been done and what you would like to see done as far as rail safety with these unit trains. Because, be quite frank with you, I mean, we've had some derailments in the past couple of years. One was in North Dakota. Was it Minot or Dickinson? One of the two. It missed the city by about a mile. Had that thing gone off in the city, it would have been unthinkable. There was one recently in the last few years up in Canada that did go off, derailed in a public area in a small city, and in the loss of life was bad, was horrendous. So just bring us up to speed and what's been done, what you guys are working on, and what you see the future is for this issue, because I'm very uncomfortable when I got 110 cars of this stuff parked a half a mile from my people in my district, these large population centers.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Yes. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you. Representative, I can tell you that that the rail, as well as pipeline safety, has been a much talked about point of conversation within not only the Commissioner of Public Safety's office, but within the Department of Transportation, Department of Health, and I know at the Governor's office as well. And you're correct, sir, that last year there was significant focus placed upon that. I'll point out that I think last week, if I'm not mistaken, the Department of Transportation issued their report that they were tasked with providing. And at 9 o'clock this morning, the Department of Public Safety issued its report that it was tasked with providing as well. So that report came out today. It's approximately 200 pages. I'm not sure, Chair Cornish, if you've got a copy of it or not, but it certainly is available today. In both of those reports, there are recommendations coming out talking about the very issues that you've pointed out, sir. And we are moving forward with a lot of those. Since the end of last session, we have moved aggressively forward, particularly what we have in our jurisdiction of working with first responders and trying to train and provide significant safety training. And I'll actually defer to the director to talk about what we've done to this point.
Director, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, with regard to the safety training, the law last year put a requirement that all of the all the fire departments and other first responders along these rail lines that carry the commodities that you're referring to go through, at least as a first step, some initial awareness training as to what these trains are, how the cars are configured, what the risks are, what are the behaviors of the commodities on them, what happens when there's an accident. We hired two staff to do that with the money that was appropriated by the legislature, and have to this point conducted more than 30 iterations of that training. We have 40 more scheduled on the books today. We anticipate by the end of the state fiscal year we will have completed about half of our training mission, which is right on track for what our program is. Once we get past that initial awareness training, we have a couple things on our to-do list. One is to get with the responders and the elected officials and others in those communities and go through an exercise. Let's talk through what would happen and what would we do, what would you do if one of these events were to happen. We don't have the authority to regulate the traffic on the railway. Our mission is to ensure the communities along those routes of travel are as well prepared as they can be, and that we are ready to help them deal with the consequences of it. So we think we're off to a very good start with not only the study, as the Deputy Commissioner mentioned, so we have a way ahead, but also with the fundamental task of making sure that everybody knows what these things are and how we'll respond.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. That was good information, and I'm glad to hear that you're making some progress. I know that in the past, I believe, maybe Representative Schoen could correct me, but I think there were 5 ERTs in the past, or were there 7?
Yeah, there was
5. and we're talking about emergency response teams. I mean, if we follow the scenario through and we have one of these unthinkable events, I mean, the local resources are going to get overwhelmed and exhausted in about 5 seconds, okay? So we would depend on these emergency response teams. Could you bring us up to speed on how many of those we have currently and where they're located, and just give us a bird's eye view of this?
Director, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, at the end of the last legislative session, we had 1 emergency response team and 10 chemical assessment teams. As a result of the passage of the rail and pipeline safety bill, we did create a 2nd emergency response team that is now located in the Moorhead area, because for obvious reasons, coming from North Dakota, that's a high density route of travel. So we have doubled the capacity there, and we are working with them working with those chemical assessment teams. They essentially do the same kinds of things. They provide technical expertise, monitoring, simple mitigation of an accident scene, and an emergency response team, or an ERT, is simply about 3 times the size. So we've doubled our emergency response teams, and we are looking for ways to increase the capability of those chemical assessment teams so that all of the state is covered with some level of support. For the northern part of the state, we are in the process of putting a chemical assessment team, basing it out of International Falls, to cover that northern corridor where Canadian National comes in as well. So that's one of the things that we continue to study, with the goal of being to develop the capability of those 11 teams.
Representative Newberg? Okay. We have a Representative Quam, followed by Representative O'Neill. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to start out with commending the cooperative effort that we have across the state between the different agencies. A recent example was a bomb team coming down to Rochester to look at a suspicious empty suitcase setting in a gas line area. So we frequently have occurrences that we don't notice, but there are daily cooperative efforts. I do have a bit of concern in that locally, because of the shortage of commercial drivers, nationally and statewide, there have been some affiliated schools opened in greater Minnesota. There used to be standing days, at least at the Olmsted site, to be able to do testing there. And when an affiliated school opened up locally in the county, Rochester was told to discontinue allowing standing days there. And I've been trying to find the appropriate person to have a conversation, because I'd like to avoid having to legislate to allow similar VOTEX of where there's an outside or third party doing that testing. So if, you know, offline, that information can be passed on. But the question I'm really interested in is, with looking at the slides, cybercrime, ID theft, internet scams and theft. I didn't see a lot of going down to that level. And then the general processes, because during investigations, it sometimes becomes evident that there may be a victim of ID theft, or many victims. At what point is the general discussion of informing that victim, because the sooner you find out the mitigation circumstances, the loss is less. However, you do run the risk of impeding or putting at risk a broader investigation. So is there a general policy or guideline statewide? Is there some information or guidance put out to the local? Because with the internet, it's across the entire state, and some departments don't have the resources a state would. So how are we leveraging the state to assist with this burgeoning issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's a number of questions in there. First, let me deal with the cybercrime and ID theft. I mean, there are major issues in this country, as you well know, that's occurring every day. I think one of our major challenges when we start talking about internet-based or technology-facilitated crime is the scope of the violation in terms of not only statewide but nationally, and in many cases internationally. It's a significant challenge. I can tell you on a professional level within the law enforcement community around the country, we are just starting to gear up for this, and this doesn't even talk about cyber intrusion, the hacking type of things that we're talking about. We have very little capacity in that regard for cyber intrusion. Most of that's relegated to the IT departments and the security officers in not only state agencies but local units of government and businesses. As far as when we notify victims of a large-scale identity crime scheme, I think it's really based on what the current needs of the investigative authority are, the people conducting the investigation, in conjunction with the prosecuting authority, whether it's a county attorney or the U.S. Attorney's Office. I can tell you in some of the investigations we've been involved with through the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, excuse me, sorry about that. We have worked in some major cases where the U.S. Attorney's Office has actually had victim witness service providers that have spent many, many months trying to identify and notify those victims. Unfortunately, the opportunity for restitution in many of those cases is beyond our ability to provide it. But at least it's noted so that as part of the sentencing process, it can be addressed through the courts. Does that answer your question?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it does go a long way, and I would like to meet with whoever is in that area because I've had constituents that, well, with the large commercial one, many of us have constituents that have suffered this, but there are individuals. So thank you for the information.
Certainly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, if I could just comment on the first part of your comments in regards to driver and vehicle services. We will get some information to you regarding commercial driver's licenses, testing or classroom ability, and then testing sites and testing timelines as well. I don't have those numbers with you, and Director Pat McCormick is not with us today because this wasn't her area, but we will be in contact with your office.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. It's good to see you again, Commissioner. I just have a quick question. Since I do represent Monticello with the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant, I'm wondering if you could just tell us just a little bit more about what you do there in Rogers and how you're protecting our communities. It's one of the fastest growing areas of our state right now, so we'd love to hear how you're protecting the citizens.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, The essence of the radiological emergency preparedness program is to, one, understand when something happens at one of our plants, understand what is happening, and then make protective action decisions. And generally, we leave what's going on at the plant to the power company for obvious reasons. And our focus is on determining whether or not an evacuation of an area needs to be made if there is a potential release of radioactive material, how we move people out of the areas in an orderly fashion, how do we account for them, how do we take care of them, how do we decontaminate themselves or their vehicles if something happens. I mean, that's the gist of it. What we do on a daily basis is do our very best to educate everybody that lives in those areas and people who are responsible for special populations like school children, hospitals, nursing homes, transients who are traveling on the freeway through your area or staying in hotels and that. So it is a program that when I came to the division 4 years ago, I thought I understood. I understand it a lot better now, and I am amazed at the amount of activity that happens truly on a daily basis with that program. And a lot of it involves working with your local officials, your first responders, schools, the hospitals, the whole gamut of your site, but we end up, you know, we need to assure the public that we understand how these plants operate, work with the power companies to make sure that we can then make those protective action decisions, which is the jargon for deciding what to do, and then like I said, be able to move people out of harm's way until the situation is resolved.
Joe, you may want to mention how often you test those.
Yes, thank you, Deputy Commissioner. In that regard, each of the plants every other year goes through a full-scale exercise, and we not only is the plant evaluated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as to, okay, if this dial says this, if this thing happens to the reactor, what do you scientist engineer people do to maintain control of the plant, but also what are the public safety actions that we take. So this year, as a matter of fact, Representative Neal, we will be the full-scale exercise is for the Monticello Nuclear Generating Plant. The focus of the exercise, because we have to be demonstrate proficiency on a number of different scenarios, things that could happen, the focus this year is on what if there is a hostile action at the plant, i.e. A terrorist attack. How do we help support local law enforcement, those federal law enforcement agencies that might come in and the like? Does that answer your question, ma'am?
It does, thank you.
Is there O'Neill?
And just a quick follow-up, can you just let me know when that exercise is happening? And that is a question I get asked from constituents, believe it or not, quite frequently, particularly as it relates to terrorism.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we certainly will. And particularly for this hostile action one, there is what I would call a road to the exercise. There will be a number of meetings, tabletop exercises and discussions, and then actual hands-on activities that I believe culminate in August, I think. But we will certainly provide you with that training schedule for this year.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom and then Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to take you in a different path. I'm not sure, Commissioner, what your role is. We're seeing law enforcement start to implement body cameras. I don't know if any of the state patrol wears them. So my question is, what is your role in that, and which agency is kind of watching what's happening or participating in making recommendations to local law enforcement about what kinds of policies they should have and procedures to make sure that all of Minnesota law is followed in the implementation of those, just as we had involvement when squad car cameras were starting up.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom and members, excuse me, we do not, neither the BCA nor the State Patrol currently has body cams, and so we are not at a point where we are working to implement them, but we have been in direct conversation with the Minnesota Chiefs Association, with the Sheriff's Association, talking through the conversations about the legality of, and certainly the retention of the data and the classification of the data collected on the body cams. I've also been working with or had conversation with the Department of Administration, Commissioner Mossman, in that he received a request from the Duluth Police Department to classify body cam data as private at this time, and until the legislature could determine either the classification of the data or the classification of the data. And so we've had conversation about that as well. So we are in the middle and within the discussions. We don't have a recommendation at this point in time, but we will be at the table for those discussions.
All right. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to circle back real quick to the rail safety issue. I was curious if those reports were just released. One was yesterday, and one was today.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the Department of Transportation's report was issued last week.
Okay.
And ours was released this morning.
Representative Neuberger.
Quick follow-up then. Would it be possible, could you make those reports available to the members here? We have that just emailed to us for those that are interested in looking at those reports. That would be real helpful. And then also, if we could get just a summary page, or if there's some information on the chemical response teams, what their parameters are, and just the nuts and bolts of them, and especially where they're stationed around the state, that would be real helpful for us to get a picture of kind of what you're doing on this issue.
Commissioner, if we want those reports, why don't we just anybody that wants one, why don't they get a hold of my staff? That one that's about this big in spiral, it was just delivered to my office this morning. I think that must have been the report that the boilerplate language, they're due on the 15th. I got mine before 9 this morning. And that would work for a February policy session, but it's kind of quick for a January 6th session. But at any rate, would that be, does everybody want a copy of this? Or do you want to just let my LA know, and then we'll get a hold of you, save a tree or two?
Mr. Chair, staff is going to also send that to the members that we distributed that to in hard copy this morning in the electronic form. So you'll have an electronic form as well, so you can distribute it electronically without having to go through the process of all the printing.
Sounds good. Okay. And Representative Hertaus, and then Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to circle back to the Office of Justice Programs. Could you talk just a little bit more about the Crime Victim Reparation Service?
Good morning, and you state your name and title.
Good afternoon. Rayon Magnuson, I'm the Director for the Office of Justice Programs. Your question regarding reparations, that's actually one of our largest units of the Office of Justice Programs. It's primarily funded with federal and state funds. We have 10 staff that work there, and it is basically in statute to allow victims of violent crimes to file for payments or reimbursement from the state for things that have happened that they can't pay for. So the best example is the largest expenditures we had last year were for funerals. The second might be medical expenses or for counseling expenses, but there's a very strict criteria that's developed where someone is eligible, and I would guess it is less than 50% of the people that file claims actually get reimbursed.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
thank you.
And my point would be we're going to have repeated questions about access to documents. If on our committee website we had a special area where there was a link to the document site for this department, that department, etc., and then we could, both members, but also the public who listen in or attend these sessions and meetings, they'd like to be able to see that. And I think it'd be a wonderful thing for the committee to do by having that access on our website.
I'll check it out. Okay. Did you have another comment, Director?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do produce annual reports each year, and reparations is actually online right now on the OJP website if you'd like to see that data.
And while you're up here, what's the total dollar amount usually you deal with every year, your total of funds that you distribute in your different programs in OJP, just to give people an idea?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have both grant and non-grant programs. So the reparations budget, which is a non-grant program, is around $2 million a year, and $1.5 to $1.6 million of that is distributed to the claimants. In grant programs, which is separate federal, again, and state grants, it's about $50 million a year.
So you folks can realize how much money is moving through the agency. Mm-hmm. And the Battered Women's Coalition was in this year are asking for $10 million to go into crime victims, I believe. And so a lot of money floating around there. So who are we got in the list now? Anyone else? Your Representative Howell, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to say, Commissioner, that your choice and your emergency management director, I knew him as General Joe Kelly back then, and I think he will serve the state of Minnesota well in his new role. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if we were able to get some of those numbers together. Maybe it would be awesome if we could just put Ms. Weeks on the spot and maybe ask her some blindsided questions and make her uncomfortable. I don't know if that's possible. But otherwise, just send it off to if you don't have it immediately today. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative Schoen and members, I would love to bring Kate up, and you can ask her any question you want. She's just having a wonderful time at the Department of Public Safety. I do have some numbers, and they're as accurate as we can have them today as we sit here, because certainly we have a lot of, with roughly 2,000 employees at the Department of Public Safety, we have a lot of people coming and going on a daily basis. But at the Alcohol and Gambling Division, we have 19 total employees. 8 of them are sworn agents, and then the director by statute is also a sworn officer as well. And then we have, or there's 8, so 7 gambling are all sworn. The director is a sworn peace officer, and then there are 11 alcohol agents non-sworn, and 3 of those individuals are actually work in the field. At the BCA, we have, sorry, I have to get my glasses on. We have roughly 325 employees. At the lab, there are 90 employees. Sworn investigators, we have 55 agents and 10 non-sworn positions, which would be analysts. In the MNJIS division, we have 150 employees. And then training is 15 employees. At ECN, we have 9 employees. The fire marshal's office is 57. HSEM is 75. And the Office of Justice Programs is 35. And we'll add that to our presentation, so when we come back with to present our budget to this committee, we'll have those numbers available in a PowerPoint.
Anybody else? Okay, can we put Director Tuckner on the spot here for a bit and talk about the tribal casino inspections that we had kind of a dust-up with a few years ago and allegedly not getting enough inspections and what kind of a system you've got going for that now, and how often would the inspections be? And then are they on a regular schedule? Just kind of an overview of the tribal casino inspections. Go ahead. What's your official title now?
Mr. Chair, members, Michelle Tuckner, Director of Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement.
Okay, Director.
And happy to be back before you, sir. Yes, we have gotten on a regular schedule. Last time I appeared here was in 2011, and at that time no inspections had been done. This year we're scheduled to do, we try to hit each casino. There's 18 casinos, 11 tribes. We do both hands-on slot machine inspections, inspection of blackjack tables, and then we also, where available, we do kind of inspections of their slot management reports, which exposes us to all the slot machines. And what we're looking for there is the payout amounts, if they're staying within the payout range. That's the biggest complaint we get, the machine's not paying out. The tribes aren't required to provide those slot management reports, but where they do, we also inspect those. So in 2014, the hands-on of a slot machine takes about, you can do about 4 to 6 machines in a day. That's the max that can be done because of the powering up of the devices. They're all computer-based, and so it takes quite some time to do a hands-on inspection of a slot machine. But if we go to a casino, on a good day, depending upon if they have the staff available and what help we have, we can do anywhere between four and six slot machines a day. So for 2014, we had 195 hands-on inspections of slot machines, 33 blackjack inspections, and then we also review their audit each year. We're only allowed to review it, but we do go out and check each of the annual audits. And then in slot management review, we inspected 5,737 machines for compliance with payout. So those are the statistics as of today. For the next year, 2015, this was approximately 3 or 4 visits per site. Our goal is to hit 4 visits for each of those casinos for 2015.
Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you do the same for the racetracks? We have 2, both running Aces and Canterbury Downs?
The racetracks have card rooms. There's nothing in statute that gives us any regulatory authority over them, so we don't do any types of inspections of the card rooms.
Thank you. So is there any regulation or inspection then of the actual betting and how that is complying with the law or not complying with the law?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe the Minnesota Racing Commission, who has oversight of those card rooms, probably does that. They are the regulatory authority for that.
All right, questions? I've got a number of them here. Thank you very much, Director. Unless there's no other questions, we'll get back. Could I have the BCA director come down and talk a little bit about how it's going with the BCA lab and the accreditation flare-up we had back a while ago with St. Paul and your backlog, just a kind of a general thing about accreditation first, and just so the members are aware of what that is, and then how you're doing on your backlog, what's the typical wait for evidence coming in from a department now?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Again, Wade Setter, Superintendent of the BCA. Our laboratory is accredited by the ASCLAD lab. It's the Association of State Crime Lab Directors Laboratory Board International. It's an international accreditation. We actually were accredited first in 1990. We just went through a reaccreditation this past fall, and were successfully awarded accreditation in all of our disciplines. I think there's 13 or 14 disciplines that we receive accreditation for. In fact, our breath testing section, which is also called a calibration laboratory, is the first accredited calibration laboratory in the entire Midwest of the United States. So we're doing well in the accreditation. The discussion or the comments you made about a couple of years ago, last year the legislature passed an accreditation statute that requires laboratories doing certain forensic examinations to become accredited, and provided two alternatives, one either through ASCLAD or one through an alternative accreditation service. And it's my understanding the St. Paul Police Department has achieved accreditation in the fingerprint area, fingerprint comparison area, just this last fall to comply with the statute. In terms of backlog, one of the things that happened when the St. Paul Laboratory was doing chemical testing for drug enforcement, they were doing it not only for themselves but a number of other agencies in the Midwest, both were in the metro area, Washington County and Dakota County in particular. And when they were no longer able to do that because of some court challenges, our backlog in drug chemistry went from about 37 days on average to over 90 days, literally in 2 weeks. We brought that back down. We're back down to about 47 days. We received some resources in the last biennial budget to add scientists. In addition, the St. Paul Police Department contracts with us to add two scientists in drug chemistry section, so we're doing well. In terms of the other disciplines, I could provide you with a report where we're at and where we've been in terms of turnaround. On average, DNA, for example, is our largest section. About 30 of our scientists work in the DNA area. It's about a 60 to 90 day turnaround time.
Okay. Another question. How are you doing on your complement of special agents in the BCA? Is that holding about level, or do you plan to make a request in the future for more agents, or you keep it at how many are there right now? Kind of a just a background of your agents.
Mr. Chair, we have about 47 field agents at this particular point in time. That's down probably from a high of 77 about 15 years ago. That does not include the special agents in charge, myself and the assistant superintendent, who are also sworn. In terms of that, we've been in discussions with the commissioner's office as part of the budgeting process, and that's where we're at on that.
Okay. That's quite a bit down, isn't it, Director? I mean, these are the give them some idea here of what a special agent does. I know there's some different categories, but we're talking about the special agents, peace officers of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Sometimes you see them responding to crimes, assisting the sheriff's departments. You know, they've got the white crime van special agents. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, our BCA special agents are deployed in 10 field offices around the state of Minnesota. We have anywhere from 2 to 4 agents in field offices in such places as Rochester, Mankato, Wilmer, Marshall, Roseau, Bemidji. We have a regional laboratory and regional office up there. Hermantown, which is in the Duluth area, and Brainerd are some of them off the top of my head. Our agents provide services anywhere from drug enforcement assistance to local agencies. We work very closely with our local partners to murder investigations, violent crime investigations, assisting with missing persons. And, for example, when Officer Tom Decker was murdered in Cold Spring 2 years ago, we had about a dozen agents up there for 3 months. And we had just implemented, actually, in the fall of 2012, a time tracking system, because one of our challenges is quantifying the work that our agents actually do, since so much of it is in support of our local partners. And I can tell you, just as one example in that particular case, we expended 3,000 man hours in about a three-month period to bring that investigation to a successful conclusion. They do everything, technical assistance. All of our agents that work in the violent crime homicide area spend time with the medical examiner's office about 3 months in an intense It's an intense program that's unique in the country to help them understand the manner and cause of death, and that provides significant support to local agencies in death investigations that may not necessarily be violent crime, suicide, or other suspicious deaths.
Does St. Paul, when they have a homicide or a shooting like the one they had early this morning, do they typically call you, or do they have their own investigations usually on an officer involved or a homicide?
Mr. Chair, the St. Paul Police Department has their own crime scene team that responds to crime scenes. They conduct their own officer-involved shooting investigations. We do provide that service to our law enforcement partners throughout the state. We conduct about anywhere from 10 to 15 officer-involved shooting investigations a year. And most of our crime scene response, which is a team consisting of laboratory experts in crime scene processing and evidence recovery, and agents that assist with the documentation, video, and photography and diagramming of a crime scene, work primarily throughout the state, but some larger agencies, most of Hennepin County does their own. They have that provided through the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department, or the agencies provide their own. Some in Dakota County, but in greater Minnesota is where we do the bulk of our work.
And then the last question for me before we move on to Representative Schoen and Howe. How does that, are we finally done in the courts on the proprietary information on the portable breath tester, that stuff they went through about their information they didn't want to share and held up all the cases? That's been all settled?
And Mr. Chair, you're talking about the Intoxilizer 5000. There was a challenge on the code, the software that was used to use that. We actually replaced that about 3.5 years ago with the Data Master, a new system. We own the code, so we can disclose it in the event of a defense challenge. And that's a great example of something that just a case law that evolves that really eliminated the use of breath testing in the field by local law enforcement. And so what happens, it transitions the burden of that testing process from a breath testing, which is far quicker, more efficient, to blood or urine, which takes longer and, of course, more laboratory resources. We've seen a dramatic drop in our toxicology section, which does the chemical testing for drunk driving enforcement, DWI enforcement, and back, and they've really embraced the Data Master, which is the new program. There's another component of that we implemented as part of that project was e-charging. So we actually electronically record the data from the DWI arrests at the time that the officer is conducting the breath test, and we get that information much faster to the prosecutors and the courts.
Thank you much, Director. And then Representative Schoen, and then Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize this is not a budget discussion day, but since you brought it up, I've always been highly critical of the drop in number of agents at the BCA. Especially working closely with them, because that is an agency and a group that you can't look at the calls for service and say, well, we need more because they did more numbers of investigations. They're more complex, they last longer, and the detail and the evidence gathering is obviously becoming more litigious every time we turn around and seeing what's going on around the country with our internal investigations and, like you said, the officer-involved shootings. I can see a time when we're going to have some policy discussions about that, what we feel is appropriate at the state level for agencies to do their own or not. And those are things that are going to be probably, in the end, squared directly at the Department of Public Safety within the BCA. So I think that's something we need to plan for. And those drop-in agents, we've got to start bringing that back up at that agency. So I hope that good luck to you when you go to the boss and work on that. But they're extremely important.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, thank you for your support.
And Director, aren't the special agents, aren't they kind of like a cut above a little bit on the pay grade, or you have to be just about detective grade coming into that position, don't you? Quite a bit of experience. They don't just hire somebody off the street.
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right. Our special agents have to come to us with anywhere from 5 to 10 years of law enforcement experience. We require significant investigative experience. We don't hire entry-level folks right out of college. And, of course, that presents some challenges for us in terms of we'd like to think we're the best, but I would not say that at the expense of any of our local partners. We work very well with our local partners. And I think the advantage for us is we have far more experience in some major crimes, which brings experience to the table to help them assist in their own success in a criminal investigation.
Thank you, Director. And Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question goes to the arson investigation realm and using those the gas chromatograph and that type of thing. What kind of a backlog are we experiencing with those fire investigation samples that come through? Because I remember back in my days, there used to be quite lengthy delay in getting those samples processed.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I can't give you off the top of my head what the turnaround time is for arson investigations in terms of the chemical analysis for accelerants, but we can provide. I'll provide a report that summarizes our history in all of our areas. I will say this: our laboratory is the only full-service accredited laboratory in Minnesota. So it is, and I have to brag a little bit just with going through the accreditation process recently. It was my first experience with a full ASCLAD assessment. We have roughly 20 people in from all over the country, actually all over the world, to come in and go through every single area of our laboratory. And to have essentially no critical findings is a significant source. So one thing I've learned in my time at the BCA over the last 4 years is you can have the chemical analysis or the laboratory analysis that's done, you can have it done fast, you can have it done right, you can't have it both ways. So we try to sacrifice in terms of quality over speed to ensure that when we provide a report, it can be depended on by the rest of the criminal justice system. But I can provide a report of all of our turnaround times.
And Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Directors, I don't have a question, but a little bit of a comment. I'm probably one of the few people, other than maybe Representative Schoen, that's actually worked with all these departments in the Department of Public Safety. I can say with great pleasure that everybody that I've worked with there has been very professional, very good, especially with the BCA. Worked a number of homicides and in other major crimes working with the BCA agents, and they've been very professional. They're very good. They're very good at what they do. And it's an important part to a lot of the agencies in greater Minnesota, as they do not have the manpower or the resources to do an investigation such as this. I know I worked, helped with one investigation up in a county just north of my area when I was on a task force. And that homicide alone completely destroyed the entire year's budget for that agency. But without the help of the BCA, it would have been much worse. And it did take a number of years, but eventually the BCA agent, who's since retired, was able to do a conviction on that person. And I just want to thank you for all the work your employees do, and they are very good employees.
Director and Commissioner, can historically we've taken some tours over to the BCA, and it would be kind of fun if you folks are interested. I don't want to ride over in the prison bus like we did that one time, but cops get kind of funny behind bars. But if we could get a trip over there and go through the lab in a different place you took us before, it's really interesting for you folks if you want to go there. I get especially euphoric when I get into the gun room myself, but it's a great tour. So we'll work on that because I think we'll have some time in between overviews and bills start rolling out. So,
Mr. Chair, we'll work with you and your committee administrator to arrange that. We'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Representative Quam, you look like you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that lab the same or in conjunction with the same facility that the Department of Health has their analytical facilities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, no, it is not. Our lab is a criminal forensic science laboratory. The Department of Health is, I think, deals primarily with epidemiology and other aspects that are specific to the health profession. It's in a different facility.
Okay.
Director, what happened to the past director that his name is hard to pronounce, Dole?
Dolish.
What?
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Frank Dolish, the lab director,
mm-hmm.
retired after, I think, 38 years of service to the state of Minnesota. He's happily retired, comes in and gives tours of the BCA on occasion to the public. He is quite a horticulturist. He's become a master gardener and doing very well.
You say he comes in to give tours?
Right. We have retired employees that we get a lot of requests for public tours of the facility for schools and other folks that are interested. So we have retired employees that provide that service.
Well, tell him I asked about it. Maybe he can come back when we have our tours.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair.
All right. Has anybody got any questions? Was this the last division that you had there? Any questions from the committee on anything? We'll have a chance to, as we mull all this over, when we get them back in the hot seat for the budget request and the governor's budget comes out, and we'll go over it then line by line, item by item. So, All right. Any folks, anything else? Otherwise, we meet when?
Next Tuesday, Joe.
Next Tuesday. And hope you can all make it. And thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.